It's interesting for me as a historian of science to always get to study science and scientists and to speak with them, but I'm very curious to hear what Arend's thoughts are of the history that he's just heard. So
that was fascinating, thank you. You know, the first thing that comes into my mind listening to your history is that how much ideology influences science. So we brought up or we taught that we need to look at science as something really objective, something that, you know, you come out without like tabula rasa, everything empty, a piece of paper, and you want to, you know, think about hypotheses, how to check them, how to disprove them or prove them and so on. But here you come and say that actually consciousness or not consciousness in our mind or not in our mind, actually our ideology, our politics is actually playing such an important role. So do you think that today as well here in the West, in synthetic biology, in agriculture, we are still prisoner of such politics and ideology?
It's an interesting metaphor to call it prison.
Okay.
I don't know if prison is the metaphor that I would use, but I think, of course, we live in the world as beings with institutional contexts, with funding possibilities, with questions that are of interest to us, and sometimes with the possibility to find that funding by answering questions somebody else wants, right? So it's not a prison that one is in, but it does condition, of course, the kind of work that we end up doing. So there is no escape from being a human in the world, is what that means. Now, that's not to say that things are automatically going to turn Lysenkoist at any possible moment. That's, of course, not the outcome.
They are not like this now? That's the question. Maybe we are under a Soviet kind of regime of thoughts and we are not aware of it, because yeah. I guess that they were not aware of it back then. So.
Well, and one can make the argument that that's not too far from the kind of obviousness of hybrid corn in an American national context, for instance, yeah. and how very differently that story would look in Mexico, where producing expensive corn that had to be bought for every generation for the farmers to plant would just not be something that would work in a different system. So I think what that shows is that national context sometimes makes a difference for what sorts of projects are pursued, and surely national context is not the only thing that makes that difference, right?
So maybe what we need to do is to put things on the table instead of under the table, meaning that to be aware that we are influenced both by politics, ideology, as well as our personal trajectory in life, and not try to be completely objective, not claim that we are objective, but actually work under the assumption that we are, you know, human beings, as you said, rather than, you know, machines that test hypotheses and so on. Maybe we need to change the way we actually teach children how to think about science.
Well, you would know this better than I do, but I have the impression that science is very hard already as it is.
That's true.
And so there's a great deal of training and work that goes into being able to accomplish the things according to the methods that need to be done. But there's certainly room for other ways of thinking about how science is done and for other people who study science, not as scientists do, to point out the assumptions or the framings or the contexts that begin to produce the kinds of conditioning of the work that we see. And so it would be lovely if every scientist were as open-minded in that way and as well-trained as you seem to be to think of all these other dimensions of science in addition to the very technical ones. But I don't think that's a requirement for scientists to need to do that. There should be enough room in our larger ecology of research that we can have places for many different kinds of work and that they can be mutually informing of each other.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my thought.
Let me move on to another point. So you mentioned also very interesting for me the thinking about life in outer space, not just, you know, it's something very, you know, contemporary. In the last 10 years, people are talking all the time about finding the indication, you know, exoplanet and so on. But it's very interesting to see that
and
also...
And it is remarkable. Exoplanet discovery is something
indeed.
That has long been thought of, but to actually have the more than 4,000 confirmed instances of exoplanets is an exciting moment for that field.
And if you ask scientists from NASA, they say that, you know, within 10, 20, 30 years, we will see the first evidence from life from outer space, whether it is in our solar system or indicators in other solar systems.
And that is interesting how those 10 years keep on receding as we go forward in time. This also happens.
Exactly like cold fusion. Yeah, it's always 20 years from now. That's true. But the question is, how do you, as historians or historians of science, see this evolving, the notion of how do we need to think about, you know, life in outer space? Because this is the ultimate seed, the seed of all, the seed of life that starts everything. So how does this evolved in the last century?
So that's very interesting. One of the things that makes me think of is today a lot of the language is that's being used is of habitability,
yeah.
that we might find a place that is habitable. And what does that mean? Many times that seems to mean that it would have liquid water, that it's in a habitable zone surrounding a star. And that concept goes back to the 1950s, certainly, and back to the late 19th century, and it ties in with larger histories of colonization on Earth, the idea of habitable places for people to live. If we look over the century and we go earlier, we can see things like the RAND Corporation producing a report called Habitable Planets for Man. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of a place where life could live also being a place where humans could live, and that that colonization idea was baked into that idea of habitability at the height of the Cold War, is interesting. If we go earlier back in time, we have the appropriation of the language of humanoids from science fiction that's being used. And earlier than that, it was men of other planets and other worlds. So there's a story we could tell of going from these ideas of life in other places being that they would be like us, to they'd be kind of like us, to, well, maybe we'll find some animals there, a silicon giraffe or something, is what Carl Sagan joked about on Mars.
So they see life there as a very similar or mimicking the life here.
As very similar, except it gets smaller and smaller as you go on. Then it becomes, yeah. well, maybe we'll find just some plants or some algae. And then it becomes, well, not even life itself. We don't have to find life there to feel successful in the quest. We can find habitability. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting story if a historian were looking at this to be able to show that.
Well, I would
that.
Claim from my perspective that thinking that we'll find something which is similar or mimicking what we have here is very, very naive. You know, I could use even worse words than that because, yeah. you know, I'm going to talk about it, about how chaotic is the process of life itself, mm-hmm. how minute changes in the condition, starting condition, or the environment can lead to completely different results. So assuming that, you know, another trajectory of evolution for 4 billion years will eventually lead to giraffes is almost ridiculous, yeah. yeah?
And this has been an interesting debate in the field for a long time,
yeah.
where a paleontologist, G.G. Simpson, you know, back in 1960 or so, wrote about the non-prevalence of humanoids in the universe. And what he knew from the history of paleontology was it was a history of contingency, that there was nothing to be expected that would ever happen again the same way twice.
Yeah.
But this idea that there could be commonalities of life here and seeds of life as they might have emerged in other places, either from a common origin or because of some other convergent feature of evolution, has been a part of actually practical efforts, and what got called, in the American context at least, planetary protection, that you'd want to make sure you don't bring back bugs from the moon and have them brought to Earth and cause some sort of pandemic here, you know? And so that idea...
Now it's, of course, the opposite.
And now it's...
We don't want to bring our pandemic to outer space.
That's right, or we don't want to contaminate some other place with seeds that have come from Earth
yeah.
that would then make it impossible to know what the indigenous life forms would have been in another place. And, of course, we can, and there are scholars who've looked at this in wonderful ways and who've said that that language of barriers and of preventing contamination is echoing the language of containing communism
yeah.
at this time, that everything deserves its own protective
Which we, again, we
sphere.
Go back to ideology again. It's exactly like, you know, the Soviet notion that everything can transmute to everything. If I'm going back, it sounds to me very Soviet, you know. Everything is equal, everything can, you know, everything has the potential to become everything,
yeah.
while in the West they focused about individual species, individual genes, something which is, you know, very West and not very Soviet. So.
Well, what I also find interesting about that story is that the dreams of what I call Prometheanism on both sides were shared dreams, these ideas that you'd be able to remake living things according to whatever your desires were. And it might not be that you'd produce wheat from rye immediately, but certainly you could produce a better form of wheat, a better form of corn. These ideas are shared across many different contexts in earlier years. What Lysenkoism does is it creates a fissure. It makes it impossible for those kinds of earlier Promethean sorts of claims to be taken seriously among geneticists in the West because it starts to sound too much like Lysenkoism. And you can see that in letters that they write. That they start to discover other forms of systems of heredity, plasma genes, and things like this, that one has to be very careful how one describes heredity so that it doesn't end up sounding like something that's now become problematic in very complicated ways.
So from my perspective, in spite of the big difference between the West and East in this regard, they are both still trapped in the trap of, you know, of tinkering, which I'm going also to talk about. Mm. Basically, taking something that already exists and manipulating it, interbreeding, changing the environment, but there is still no engineering there. No one of them, they could have dreamt about engineering, but none of the stuff that they do is really engineering. It's more like, you know, it's playing, it's seeing what's happening if you press here, if you do that. It's like tinkering, textbook approach of tinkering. So how much these people 50 years ago, 70 years ago really thought that we are going to stand here at this stage in which we can do actual engineering, not just tinkering.
So that's where the historian would say, well, a lot of people have thought that they've been doing engineering for a long time. Okay. You might not like to recognize their way of doing it as fitting what you understand to be engineering, but they called what they did engineering. And of course, they knew what engineering was at that time, right?
I have
and
a so problem
we can,
with that.
We can look, the phrase genetical engineering dates back to the early 1930s. The 1970s use of the term genetic engineering initially meant eugenics and then became applied as the generic term for recombinant DNA work that was being done. Yeah. And now we have these new fields that I think we'll be hearing more about as synthetic biology, where these ideas of properly engineering things come back. But certainly we can trace the history of trying to engineer life right back into the late 19th century, and that was the term that they used.
Well, I would claim that if you don't know what you're doing, you're just playing around, but you don't know what you're going to get, and you don't have the mathematical framework to design it, you cannot really call it engineer. Uh-huh. And they didn't have the mathematical framework, and they didn't know what we are going to get. They just, you know, play around to see what's happening. So I think that, you know, it's almost a dictionary level of what is engineering, and I think that if they call themselves engineers, they were really too optimistic about what they're doing.
I think
even us are too optimistic these days uh-huh. about the level in which we can actually, you know, take a system and completely engineer it.
So that understanding of engineering being defined in this particular way and that they didn't have it, I would prefer to see it like the story of when will we discover life, that there's this shifting idea of what counts as proper engineering and that changes just as our technologies have been changing as well. So I think that would be a way to both understand why somebody in the 1890s could say, well, to properly understand life would mean that one would be able to produce it from scratch in the test tube, and that is the ultimate goal someday of an engineering biology, that would carry right through the 1930s, 1970s, and to today. It doesn't need to be the same engineering in all those times, but I think that historical process of what counts as a properly engineered approach to biology is an interesting phenomenon, at least for the historian.
Thank you, Lewis.
Yes, wonderful. I look forward to hearing.
And now what I will try to tell you a little bit about, if I will find my presentation. Yeah.